A question to begin. Do we need insurance? Do you need insurance? Many people conclude that they don't need insurance because it's too expensive. Have you ever made that decision? And then you have a car accident, or you injure yourself, or the tree falls on your house or your deck. I remember those kinds of things do happen. Insurance is always too expensive until an emergency occurs, and then when you look back on it, boy, it sure would have been cheaper to have bought that insurance. Sometimes we as Christians conclude that we don't need insurance. It's unnecessary because we are Christians. We are God's people. And people see that purchasing insurance is a lack of faith. If we have faith in God and God is with us, we really don't need insurance. But the fact is, God wants us to do what we can in faith, and He will provide what we cannot. He does give us a principle that alludes to insurance. It doesn't mention it directly, but it gives us a principle that we need to keep in mind as we think about this particular subject. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 22. Proverbs chapter 22, verse 3. Proverbs 22, verse 3 gives us a principle. That's a principle that we're going to take a look at it at, and then it's a principle that will be fundamental to what we're going to talk about today. Proverbs chapter 22, verse 3. There it says, a prudent man, a man with wisdom, a prudent man foresees evil. So that individual who has wisdom, that individual who has prudence, he looks out ahead of him and he sees, there's danger ahead. There's a difficulty ahead. He foresees it and hides himself. He doesn't just go along headlong, there's danger there, and who cares, I'm going to go ahead anyway. He sees it, and he gets out of the way. But the simple pass on and are punished. The simple don't care. They just go headlong, straight ahead, and as a result of that, they suffer the consequence. The verse is saying that we know that we will face emergencies and accidents, and we need to be prepared for those eventualities. We're to watch and be ready for evil that may come our way, and that would apply physically and it would apply spiritually. So there is a physical application and a spiritual application. It is wisdom to prepare ahead, to look ahead, to foresee danger and try to be prepared for it. I would like to apply this principle laid out in this verse to our everyday financial and economic lives. Currently, I think everybody that is here has a place to live. I think everybody has food on the table. I think we have clothes to wear, we have transportation, and some form of income. But could all of that change? Could the economy go into a tailspin characterized by the stock market plummeting even further? There's a great deal of uncertainty in the stock market. And basically, for the last few years, the stock market has been propped up by the federal government, in order because that's really the only place you can make money, keep your interest rates low, and that's where people will put their money. Could there be bank closures? My brother is in real estate, and in California, told me that Bank of America and Wells Fargo Bank are in trouble. How about job losses? Here in Texas, things are prosperous, but if you go up to other parts of the country, job losses are a very real part of life. And I'm sure they are to an extent here, but they're even worse elsewhere. What about drought and crop failure? Here, this year, we've lost, as I said, most of the cotton crop has been, the wheat crop, I think, was entirely lost, part of the cotton crop. And I think people in Texas are selling off their herds because they can no longer afford to feed the cattle. The corn prices are high, so they're getting rid of their herds. And as a result of that, our beef prices are low. But once the herds are gone, that's going to change. So enjoy steak while you can. And so I'll be loading up at the feast to make sure I get my portion before it's all over. And it's $20 for that 3-ounce ribeye or whatever it is. So anyway, we... there could be drought and crop failure. And not only do you have the problems of drought here, which we've experienced in Texas, but up where we lived, it rained and rained and rained and rained. And that's sometimes worse for your crops because it causes other problems. What about the government being unable to fund its obligations? Unable to fund Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid? Those would all be serious things. And I'm not trying to scare everybody here, but what's your plan if you lose your job and there's not one to be had? What happens if you lose your home? I hope that that never happens. What happens if there is no food available? What happens if you don't have money to buy food or even the finances to make the trip to the store? If economic calamity hits, what is your plan? What is your plan? The Bible, as we'll see, tells us that these things can happen. And they don't just happen to people in the world, they happen to us too. When it hits the world, if we happen to be in the right place at the right time or the wrong place at the wrong time, it can affect us as well. So America has enjoyed great prosperity over the last 60 years, my lifetime. 60 years of prosperity. But could all that change? If we go back in history, we find a president in our nation of difficult times hitting. In the 1920s, they had great prosperity. It was a very prosperous time. But what happened in 1929? You had the Great Depression hit as the stock market crashed. And some of you who are older, you probably remember what that was like. And us, those of us who are younger, we think all of these old people, they're all fanatical about taking care of their money and being very frugal. What's wrong with you? Well, they grew up in a different time, when time was tough. When times were tough and you had to be very frugal. The economy foundered at that time. The factories and businesses shut down. Men were out of work. There were food lines. There was poverty. There was homelessness. Tent cities. Hobos traveling the rails and the roads trying to find a job. It was a tough time for people. Making the problem worse were crop failures. You had the Dust Bowl at that particular time, and you had bad government policy making the bad time worse. One thing to consider about the Depression is that it hit the whole nation, and it hit Christians as well. God's people were around at that time, and they had to go through it. We live in uncertain times, and while we cannot foresee every problem that may come our way, we as Christians must do what we can to try to be ready when economic calamity comes. And you may be saying, well, it's never going to happen. Well, I hope it never does. But if you look at the world and you read about the news and you watch the news, things aren't exactly certain. There is a great deal of upheaval and uncertainty in many parts of the world. Following the instruction that we find in Proverbs chapter 22, verse 3, we are not to go our merry way oblivious to the dangers that are around us. If we continue to live naively or foolishly, we will suffer unnecessarily. We instead have to be prudent. I think living where we live here in Houston, don't you have to be aware that there could be an emergency, something called a hurricane? Those do occasionally hit here. Doesn't look like they're going to hit this year unless there's a rush job between now and the 1st of October. Somebody said if there is no tropical depression or anything like that by the 1st of October, pretty much it's very unlikely that you're going to have anything like that. And the area basically depends on that to replenish your reservoirs and things like that. So so many of you live in areas where the hurricane can impact you, so you probably are aware of taking emergency procedures to get out of the way. I was talking to some people this week after the funeral in Angleton, and they were saying, well, we get out of town. And I would say that's probably prudent. And other people said, well, we just tough it out. Well, okay, if you're ready for it, that's good. Being prudent means to see the evil that's coming your way and to take measures to lessen the impact. You hide yourself so it doesn't impact you. Doesn't mean hiding yourself doesn't mean burying your head in the sand. It means finding the best way to avoid being overwhelmed by the challenge. Finding the best way to meet the test that may come. And as we look at the Scriptures, we find that God's people throughout history have had to face hard economic times. And so what we want to do is look at their experiences and what happened in their lives and how they dealt with it. And we have a number of different examples in the Scriptures. The first one we'll look at is Noah. Noah didn't just lose his job, he lost his world. The world he lived in came to an end. God destroyed it. And when that boat came to rest on Mount Ararat, there were 8 people, a bunch of animals, and they all exited the ark and began life over. But you're 1 of 8 living on the earth at that time. So your whole world has been destroyed. Now, why did Noah survive? Why is it that Noah survived? Let's go to Genesis chapter 6 and just recount why Noah survived that. Genesis chapter 6. Genesis chapter 6, verse 5. And these are the conditions that existed then. It says, "Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." Now this sounds like this is way back in ancient times. It has no application to today. Or does it? The world had reached a condition where the thoughts and intents of man's heart was only evil continually. Are we moving towards such a world? "And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. So the Lord said, 'I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast, creeping thing and birds of the air, for I am sorry that I have made them.'" But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. Why did God extend grace to Noah? Bottom line is, Noah was a Christian. God extended grace to him because of his mercy. And Noah recognized that God extended him that mercy. We go on to see here that it says in verse 9, this is the genealogy of Noah. Noah was a just man. Now he tried to live by a life of integrity, but he also was justified by the sacrifice of Christ, and he was perfect in his generations. That means he lived a life that was exemplary, a life that he was blameless in the sense that he couldn't be accused. He wasn't perfect, he sinned, but he was forgiven of his sins. He goes on to say here that God was going to, he looked on the earth in verse 12, "And indeed it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. And God said to Noah, 'The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And behold, I will destroy them with the earth. Make yourself an ark of gopher wood.'" So he was instructed to build an ark. He was instructed to put all sorts of stores on there, to feed the animals, and to take care of life for whatever the duration would be. And God could have built the ark, and God could have done all of it. But he had man do it and take the steps to prepare things. And Noah survived because of his relationship with God. He walked with God. And it's an instruction for all of us that if we want to survive what is coming our way, then we must walk with God as well. So, following God's instruction, he built the ark and he gathered the food that he and his family and the animals would need. And let's go to Matthew chapter 24 and see that there is a tie-in between what happened here and what's going to happen at the end of the age. Matthew chapter 24. Matthew chapter 24, verse 36. "So Noah, before the flood actually hit the earth, he went to the world. And it appears that for 120 years he spoke to the world. He tried to convince them to change their evil ways and turn to God. And they didn't. They didn't. And we don't know how many people lived in Noah's time. But they did not respond, and they were wiped out in the flood. Let's go to Matthew chapter 24, verse 36. It says, "But of that day," that is the day when things are going to unfold, that Christ has talked about, and the time of Christ's coming, "of that day and hour no one knows, not even the angels in heaven, but my Father only. But as the days of Noah were, so also will be the coming of the Son of Man." When the flood started, people were shocked. People were shocked as everything began to flood. They had mocked Noah, had made fun of him, and once the flood started, the ship was closed and you couldn't get on. The ship had sailed in the truest sense of that. He says, "For as in the days before the flood, they were eating and drinking, marrying and giving in marriage until the day that Noah entered the ark." Life went on as normal. And they didn't recognize what was coming, even though they received the warning from Noah. And the Bible warns us to look at the signs and look out ahead. What's out ahead of you? And to take appropriate action in light of what's coming. Knowing that, we need to be prepared not only spiritually but physically. The two go hand in hand. Are we spiritually prepared? Are we looking at the times and taking that into consideration? You know, it talks about the 10 virgins, and 5 of them didn't prepare, 5 of them did. So it would behoove us to go ahead and get prepared to make sure that our lamp is ready. Are we physically prepared? Is there any physical preparation that we should make? I think, you know, as you live here and you've lived in a place where there are hurricanes and that kind of thing, then you probably do make physical preparations of some kind. You have some water and some food and those kinds of things around, and it's prudent to do that. Moving on in the book of Genesis, we move on to Abraham's time. Let's go to Genesis chapter 12. Verse 10. Genesis chapter 12, verse 10. Abraham was called out, and God led him to the land of Canaan, where he began to live in that land. But in time, conditions got quite bad. In chapter 12, verse 10 of Genesis, it says, "Now there was a famine in the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to dwell there, for the famine was severe in the land." The famine was so severe that there was not enough food. So where did he go? He went to where food was plenteous. He went to Egypt, which had the blessing of the Nile River. And the Nile River was usually flowing. It would flood, and there was plenty of food there. That was one of the things that the Nile River Valley was blessed with. So you go where food is available. So what Abraham did was find the best way to avoid being overwhelmed by the challenge, and that meant going down to Egypt. So even a faithful man like Abraham, the father of the faithful, had to face such a challenge. And he didn't blame God for his adversity. He did what he had to do to survive the hard times, and most importantly, God was with Abraham and his family as they went down to Egypt. He protected him and watched out for him. And then eventually, when the famine passed, he was able to return to the land of Canaan. So we see here that even the faithful suffer famine at times, and sometimes the faithful have to move to deal with the famine. And what we see is that God provides a way out of the circumstance. So as we look at these examples, we should see that, yes, there may be adversity. There may be some very challenging times, but God says there is a way out. And God will provide it for us. Let's go forward in time to the time of Joseph. We're familiar with the story where Joseph was sold into slavery and ended up ultimately in prison in Egypt. And while there, he ran into a couple of the servants of Pharaoh. And one of them was ultimately executed, and the other one began to work for Pharaoh once again. And Joseph had told him, "Hey, when you get out, if you can help me out here, I would appreciate it." But once the servant was freed and went back to his job, he forgot all about Joseph. Until Pharaoh began having dreams. The first dream involved 7 fat cows and 7 lean cows. And Interestingly, in the dream, the seven lean cows ate the seven fat cows. Pharaoh thought, well, that's a strange dream. It must have been something that I ate and went back to sleep. Then he had a second dream. And the second dream involved a stalk of grain with seven fat heads. And then that's a stalk of grain that had seven lean heads that didn't have much on them. And those seven lean heads ate the seven fat heads. And at this point, this Pharaoh is very troubled about the dream. So he called his magicians and his wise men and says, what does this mean? And they said, we don't know. And at that point, that individual who had interacted with Joseph said, hey, I remember a guy who was a dreamer. Let's call him over. And they did. And so Pharaoh told Joseph the dream. And he said, can you interpret it for me? And Joseph said, I can't interpret it, but the God that I worship can. The God that I worship can help me to understand what those dreams represent. Because, you know, there are two dreams that have taken place, so obviously God is trying to tell you something. So Pharaoh told Joseph his dreams, and then Joseph responded with what they represented. And so we come to Genesis chapter 41, and let's look at verse 29. Chapter 41 of Genesis, verse 29. And what Joseph told him was that these seven fat cows and the seven good grains, seven heads of good grain, those represented seven good years. And the seven lean cows and the seven rather light heads of grain are going to represent seven bad years when there's going to be famine, when there's going to be no abundance, and those seven lean years are going to devour all of the abundance of the first seven. Genesis chapter 41, verse 29. Genesis chapter 41, verse 29. It says, indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt, but after them 7 years of famine will arise, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will deplete the land. Imagine those conditions where we live. It's hard to imagine. I've lived 60 years and I've never seen a store without food. Have you? I've never seen that. But it's telling you that there could be a time when the shelves are bare. Not sure when that's going to be, but it could be. So anyway, it says that all of that, the good is going to be gone. And the fact that the dream was repeated twice tells you that it's established by God, and God will shortly bring that to pass. So Joseph's advice, Joseph basically was applying the principle of foreseeing evil and doing something about it. So what does he advise? He tells us, beginning in verse 33, he says in verse 33, now therefore let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. So select somebody who has discernment and wisdom. Let Pharaoh do this and let him appoint officers over the land to collect 1/5 of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 plentiful years. So he says, let that man be in charge and develop a plan and have people that will help him carry this plan out. And verse 35, and let them gather together all the food of those good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. Then that food shall be as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine. So he says, let's get this, you need to get somebody that knows how to do this, that can get this organized, and that the food can be set aside for the bad years. And then we go down to see what Pharaoh's response was. So we see that the Pharaoh said, this is an awfully smart, a wise and discerning person. Why don't you be in charge? And you know, the interesting thing is you look at this story, and it's a story with which many of us are familiar. But as you look at the story and how it plays out over years, God is putting in place a way to save His people. He's putting Joseph in a particular position and in a particular place and in a particular time in order that the family of related to Abraham is going to be saved. Because God has made a promise to them. And God is working all of this out. So let's go down to verse 46. It says there, and Pharaoh called Joseph's names, gave him a particular name. Let's go to verse 46. That Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. Now in the 7 plentiful years, the ground brought forth abundantly. So he gathered up all the food of the 7 years which were in the land of Egypt, and laid up the food to the in the cities, and he laid in up in every city the food of the fields which surrounded them. And Joseph gathered very much grain, as the sand of the sea, until he stopped counting, for it was immeasurable. So he got he used his wisdom and discernment and his organizational skills to get all of this together and to make sure that all of the grain was gathered up, and it was a massive amount of grain. Going on in verse 53, it says, then the 7 years of plenty which were in the land of Egypt ended, and the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph had said. The famine was in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. So when the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. Then Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph, whatever he says to you, do. The famine was all over all the face of the earth, and Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. And the famine became severe in the land of Egypt, so that all countries came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain, because the famine was severe in all lands. So we see the region of Egypt being struck by famine. And we see Joseph was God's instrument to foresee the evil and get out of its way by preparing in the good years. And then when the bad years hit, they were ready. So I don't believe any of us have been given dreams of 7 good years and 7 lean years. That's not how God works in most cases now. He's given us the scriptures to look at and to be able to learn lessons and apply those lessons. We do know that hard economic times can hit. And as we look at things in our world, there is a lot of uncertainty. And consider where you live. As I said, we've had a very dry year. Down in Angleton, the funeral director was saying that they're about 24 inches shy of what they usually have. And that's pretty serious. That's a lot of rain to make up in a little amount of time. And the question I had as I was standing there and they're talking about the heat and the drought and all of that, my question to them was going to be, why do you think this is happening? Is it just something that's normal? Is just the normal cycle of things? I've heard that droughts of this kind have gone for 10 years in Houston. That boy, our grass is going to look really brown here, a lot browner than it does now. But anyway, how's that all going to work out? We have rain today, and I'm very thankful for that, and hopefully we can get more. But what happens if it doesn't rain in another year? What will conditions be like? Knowing the potential challenges that lie ahead, we can follow Joseph's example, and in the good years prepare for what lies ahead. And that's the lesson that you can learn from Joseph. Hey, if there are good times, let's be careful and let's use it wisely and let's set some of it aside for the future. And we can do so with food and finances if need be. The fool or simple would continue on in the prosperity until calamity hit. And action would only be taken once the calamity hit. And once the calamity hits, it's hard to catch up. So take advantage of where you're at and make the most of it. Let's go to another time that God's people faced challenges, in the time of the judges. And that's found in the book of Ruth. And the book of Ruth begins with a famine in the land. And the famine was so severe that the family of Elimelech which included Naomi and two sons, had to give up their God-allotted portion of land in the area of Bethlehem. So times got so bad that they sold their land. And eventually they had no place to live, and they heard that things were better in the land of Moab, so they moved there. And the two sons married women from the land of Moab. And they took up residence there, and the sons and the father of the household died. So all that was left was a Naomi, the widow, and her two widowed daughters-in-law. And times were tough there, and the challenge for them was they had no man of the house to take care of them. But they heard that things were better back in the land of Israel, and so that God had restored things there to where there was food available. So they moved back to the land of Israel, back to their hometown, Bethlehem. And they just hoped that as they moved back that God would at least help them to survive. They didn't expect to prosper. But they hoped that God would take care of them. And we know that Naomi went back and she offered her daughters a way out. And one of the daughters said, "Well, I'm going back to my family." The other said, "I'm going with you back to the land of Israel." Ruth made that journey with her. And as we know from the story, God took care of them, didn't he? And God had, and they had land that was allotted to them, which they had sold, but they had no way to buy it back. And the only way to buy it back was to go to your kinsman redeemer and ask that the kinsman redeemer would intervene for you. And things worked out to where Boaz was their kinsman redeemer, and he was willing to do it. He was willing to buy back their land and to restore that land to the family that of Naomi and Ruth. So he was willing to do that, to be allow them to be restored. And, you know, as we look at that situation, we see that, you know, we can go through adversity and difficulty, and we all have a kinsman redeemer. And that kinsman redeemer, of course, is Jesus Christ. And no matter what we go through, he's there for us, and he will redeem us, and he will bring us through whatever we have to face. Whatever challenge that we face, God says that he will be with us. Just as he was with Ruth and Naomi. And what you see as you go through the Bible and the other examples here, you see that God is always with his people. And they face adversity and things can get pretty tough, but God is always with them and finds a way to bring them out of it and bring them through it. Another example takes place in the time of a king by the name of Ahab. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 17. And this brings up Ahab and a prophet by the name of Elijah. And this particular prophecy has some direct correlations with the end of the age, because Elijah is a type of one of the two witnesses that will ultimately come on the scene. 1 Kings chapter 17. 1 Kings chapter 17. Now, Ahab was assumed the throne after the death of his father Omri, and Omri was a famous king in Israel and quite prominent in the ancient Middle East. In fact, you have his name applied people of Israel by the Assyrians. But Ahab is condemned for continuing in the sins of the first king of the northern kingdom, Jeroboam. He not only did what Jeroboam did, but he added to it. And the problem was he married a woman by the name of Jezebel. And Jezebel was very much into Baal worship. He married her and brought her into the kingdom. And Jezebel was zealous for Baal worship and began to promote Baal worship in the land of Israel. And basically she was a type of the great harlot that rode the beast, and she rode Ahab, and he basically did what she wanted. And she began to persecute God's prophets, and they had to go into hiding and all kinds of challenges on the religious front. But because of what Ahab was doing and the sins that were being committed in that time as he was leading Israel astray, God said, "I'm going to punish you." And let's go to chapter 17 of 1 Kings, verse 1. It says, "And Elijah the Tishbite of the inhabitants of Gilead said to Ahab, 'As the Lord God of Israel lives, before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years except at my word. So a famine is coming upon the land. And he said, there isn't going to be any rain, and there isn't going to even be any dew except at my word. And the famine went on for 3.5 years. 3.5 long years. And the drought was apparently a forerunner and type of a future drought that's referred to in Revelation chapter 11. However, the drought that's going to take place at the end of the age is going to be much wider and more serious in scope than the one in Elijah's time. So, 1 Kings chapter 17, verse 2. 1 Kings chapter 17, verse 2. It says here, the word of the Lord came to him saying, so God's going to provide a way out for Elijah. He's going to provide for him, He says, get away from here and turn eastward and hide by the brook Cherith, which flows into the Jordan. And it will be that you shall drink from the brook, and I have commanded the ravens to feed you there. So God made special provision for Elijah. He said, I'm going to take care of you. And so he said, you need to hide out, and I'll make sure you have something to drink, and I'm going to have the ravens bring you food. Now, that would be quite an unusual thing if the ravens bring us food and there's water for us to drink, but if he could do it for Elijah, he can do it for us as well. So he says to hide out, and he provided for him. And God did bless him in that way. But things didn't get better. They got worse. The drought goes on. Verse 5, so he went and did according to the word of the Lord, for he went and stayed by the brook Cherith, which flows into the Jordan. The ravens brought him bread and meat in the morning and bread and meat in the evening, and he drank from the brook. And it happened after a while that the brook dried up because there had been no rain in the land. So eventually, there's nothing for the ravens to bring and there's nothing to drink. So what does he do? It's interesting what he does, actually. Things have gotten worse, and where does he go? Let's go to verse 8. Then the word of the Lord came to him, saying, arise, go to Zarephath, which belongs to Sidon, and dwell there. So he's to go to this particular town and dwell in this town that's fairly near the city of Sidon. Now, what's significant about Sidon? Sidon and Tyre are part and parcel. They're Phoenician cities that are very much part of the Baal worship. So here God says, I want you to move into the heart of Baal worship. That's where I want you to go. I want you to go and I want you to live there. And the person that's pushing Baal worship, Jezebel's looking for Elijah and would love to take his life. And so anyway, he goes to this city called Zarephath. And it says there, see, I have commanded a widow there to provide for you. So he arose and went to Zarephath. And when he came to the gate of the city, indeed a widow was there gathering sticks. And he called to her and said, please bring me a little water in a cup that I may drink. And you know, this widow probably thought, hey, have you not noticed that there's a drought and there's virtually no water around and I'm going to go get water and give it to you? It doesn't say what she said, but I wonder what went through her mind. And so he asked her for water. And as she was going to get it, and so she's actually going to help him out. She's going to go get the water. And he called to her and said, please bring me a morsel of bread in your hand. So not only get me some water, but could you bring me a morsel of bread? And I'm sure at that point she may have thought, hey, you're really pushing it here. I was going to give you a drink of water, and now you're pushing it and you want food? And so she said, as the Lord your God lives, I do not have bread, only a handful of flour in a bin and a little oil in a jar. And see, I am gathering a couple of sticks that I may go in and prepare it for myself and my son that we may eat and die. And Elijah said, do not fear. Go and do as you have said, but make me a small cake from it first and bring it to me. And, you know, for this woman to go get him a drink of water and to provide a cake for him to eat was a major step, stepping out in faith by this woman. She doesn't have much. Why should she do this? And yet he asked her. This is a test that she was being given here. And afterward, make some for yourself and your son. So serve me first. And then verse 14, for thus says the Lord God of Israel, the bin of flour shall not be used up, nor shall the jar of oil run dry until the day the Lord sends rain on the earth. So he said, you know, if you do this, then you will be blessed. You will be provided for. And that barrel with the bin with the oil and the flour and all of that, you're not going to be out of oil or flour until the day that the famine is through. And God fulfilled His promise. He did exactly what He said He was going to do. And they, you know, it may have gotten pretty old. What are we having today? Well, I'm going to use the flour and the oil, and I'm going to make a cake for us to eat. Is that it? That's it. That's all we've got. But at least you have that. And some of you, if you remember back to when times were hard, you remember back that you had pretty much the same meal day after day. It's not like you have now. You went to the store and there's all sorts of variety. It may have been beans and cornbread or whatever it may have been in your part of the world, but that's all you had. And you may have complained about it. And I know some people won't eat certain things because they ate it so many times as a kid. I can't eat it. I remember back when I was young and had to eat that over and over and over again. And other people liked it. Yeah, I remember back when I was a kid and that's all we had. But they, you know, people are different. But God said He was going to provide for her. And what we see here is a reminder that God can miraculously intervene to provide for us. So as we face these challenges, you know, you always hear the hypothetical question asked of you. Now, if you had nothing to eat and you had to eat something, all that was there was unclean, or your plane crashes and all you have are dead human bodies, would you cannibalize them? You have these hypotheticals that are asked. You have to say, well, you know what? All I have to do is look at the example here of Elijah and the widow of Zarephath, and I know, you know what? God's going to provide for me. I don't know how He's going to do it, but somehow or other, there's going to be a Lara bar or a balance bar or something fall out of the sky, and I know that I'm going to be fed, you know? And something's going to happen to where I'm going to be taken care of. And you can have that, and these lessons are there, and they're repeated over and over again to reassure us of what God can and will do. Let's look at another aspect of this when times get hard. Let's go to Nehemiah chapter 5. We see another example of a famine and what's taking place with the people of Judah. Nehemiah chapter 5. Nehemiah chapter 5. And so there was a famine in the land, and things were going badly for some of the people in the land of Judah after their return from Babylon. Verse 3, it says, there were also some who said, we have mortgaged our lands and vineyards and houses that we might buy grain because of the famine. They've mortgaged everything in order to buy grain. And who are they mortgaging their land, their property to? To the other people of Judah. There were also those who said, we have borrowed money for the king's tax on our lands and vineyards. Yet now our flesh is as the flesh of our brethren, our children as their children, and indeed we are forcing our sons and our daughters to be slaves. And some of our daughters have been brought into slavery. It is not in our power to redeem them, for other men have our lands and vineyards. We don't have a way to make a living. We've had to sell it, and we've not been able to prosper to where we can buy them back. And they're telling Nehemiah about this, and what's his reaction? We find that in verse 6. And I became very angry when I heard their outcry and these words. Verse 7, after serious thought, I rebuked the nobles and rulers and said to them, each of you is exacting usury from his brother. So I called a great assembly against them. They were exacting usury from their brothers and sisters basically taking advantage of the hard times that these people were facing. So he calls them on it. Verse 9 says, "Then I said, 'What you are doing is not good. Should you not walk in the fear of our God because of the reproach of the nations, our enemies? I also, with my brethren and my servants, am leading them, lending them money and grain. Please let us stop this usury. Don't misuse the other members of our nation. Don't take advantage of them.'" Yes, the opportunity is here to do that because of the hard times, but don't do that. She says, "Restore now to them, even this day, their lands, their vineyards, their olive groves, and their houses, also a hundredth of the money and the grain and the new wine and the oil that you have charged them." So they said, "We will restore it and will require nothing from them. We will do as you say." So they restored the things to the people who had been enslaved, the people who had had to give everything up because of the difficult times. And what's the lesson for us? The lesson is that hard times are not a time to take advantage of other brothers and sisters in Christ. Take advantage of others. It's inappropriate for Christians to take advantage of them. You know, we may see, I could pick up this property, or I could take advantage of them, and it says that's inappropriate. We go forward to the New Testament, and they had a famine as well. Seems like as you go through the Bible, you find this to be a problem, and we're going to find it to be a problem at the end of the age. Let's go to Acts chapter 11. Acts chapter 11, a famine that was taking place in the time of the Apostle Paul. And we see what they did about it. Acts chapter 11, verse 27. Acts chapter 11, verse 27. It says, "And in these days prophets came from Jerusalem to Antioch. Then one of them named Agabus stood up and showed by the Spirit that there was going to be a great famine throughout all the world, which also happened in the days of Claudius Caesar. Then the disciples, each according to his ability, determined to send relief to the brethren dwelling in Judea. This they also did and sent it to the elders by the hands of Barnabas and Saul." So there was a famine in the land, and they determined, hey, let's give the... And it apparently was hitting very hard in the land of Judea, and so they were determined to help them out. And, you know, as we live in this nation, we have been very blessed. And as you look at some of our other brothers and sisters in Christ in other parts of the world, they don't have it so good. And it's only appropriate that if we have and we have the opportunity to give, you know, as part of being Christians, that we would give to them. Find a way to help them out as they face the challenges that they face. So let's go to Romans chapter 15. Romans chapter 15. So people determined to give, and that's a beautiful thing in the church to see the generosity that people have in giving and serving other people and thinking of them and helping them out, and the church is repeatedly doing that. Romans chapter 15, verse 25. He says, "But now I am going to Jerusalem to minister to the saints, for it pleased those from Macedonia and Achaia to make a certain contribution for the poor among the saints who are in Jerusalem." And what's interesting about these individuals who were giving from Macedonia, Macedonia was not a wealthy area. You know, it's the area where the Philippians lived. It's an area where the Thessalonians lived, and they were not well-to-do churches. And yet they were willing to give. They were willing to help those in need. Sometimes it's a matter of, giving the widow's mite. You give that little bit, but it's given from the heart and is important to God. And that's the important thing. It says, it pleased them indeed, and they are their debtors. For if the Gentiles have been partakers of their spiritual things, their duty is also to minister to them in material things. So they helped out. Spiritual. They helped out, they'd been given spiritual things, and they helped out physically. Let's go to 1 Corinthians 16. 1 Corinthians chapter 16. Chapter 16, verse 1. It says, "Now concerning the collection for the saints, as I have given orders to the churches of Galatia, so you must do also. On the first day of the week, for each day each one of you lay something aside, storing up as he may prosper, that there may be no collections when I come. And when I come, whomever you approve by your letters, I will send to bear your gift to Jerusalem." So we are to help our brethren who might be in need. That's something that is a lesson that we find in the Scriptures. So as we conclude, let's look at the lessons that we've looked at today. Clearly, drought and famine and lack of sustenance, loss of job and home can strike God's people. They've struck God's people for thousands of years, and it can hit us as well. So if such a thing hits and wipes us out, it could last a while. So if we are struck by such challenges, we've learned that many times we have options. We have options. For instance, God provided Abraham and Jacob a place to go for food in tough times. And we have to ask God for his wisdom to see what should we do. Is there a place we can go? Is there a way that we can deal with this? And as 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 13 tells us, the way that God gives us, the way of escape. There is the way that is best for us. He provides that for us. We can follow Joseph's example and prepare for lean times in the good years. And each of us has to make that decision. Where are we at? What is our condition? And do what we feel is best in order to be prepared for the future. Be prepared and to be spiritually prepared and to be physically prepared. We want to avoid using hard times to take advantage of others. We don't want to use hard times to take advantage of other people. That's the lesson we saw from Nehemiah. And Christ brings out that lesson as well in Luke chapter 12. Let's go to Luke chapter 12, verse 45. Luke chapter 12, verse 45. Luke chapter 12, verse 45. Here it says, "But if that servant says in his heart, 'My master is delaying his coming,' and begins to beat the male and female servants, and to eat and drink and be drunk, the master of that servant will come on a day when he is not looking for him, and at an hour when he is not aware, and will cut him in two and appoint him his portion with the unbelievers. And that servant who knew the master's will and did not prepare himself to do according to his will shall be beaten with many stripes." So he's telling us, that we can't begin to say, well, Christ is delaying his coming and not be prepared. We need to be prepared. And we don't want to mistreat others, for our, selfishly. So we want to avoid that. And that's a mindset we can get into if we're not careful. We're going to have a giving heart even when we're suffering hard times. We can see that example in the New Testament church. We see that with the widow of Zarephath. And we have to be such people as well. And we can use the principle of Proverbs chapter 23 to prepare for hard times, to see the evil that may be coming our way and get out of the way. And we may be we may be rich and increased with goods. We may have a lot. So I'm well-to-do. I'm not worried about it. But the Bible says don't, put too much stock in your wealth, because that can go pretty fast. Instead, we need to be careful, and we need to realize that ultimately, to whom do we have to be dependent upon? We have to be dependent upon God. To be dependent upon God, that he will provide for us. And let's end in Psalm chapter 37. Psalm 37. Psalm 37, verses 18 and 19. We have to be dependent upon God. And I think as things play out, ultimately, if we live on to when it's all over, and we're up to that very point in time, there's going to be nowhere else we can look. Conditions are going to be such that the only being to whom we can look to survive is going to be God. We're not going to be able to, we're going to have to depend upon Him. I don't know whether we'll all have a bin of, some oil and a bin with flour in it that never runs out. I don't know what it's going to be like, but God says He'll take care of us and see us through. And He makes that point in chapter 37 of Psalms, beginning in verse 18. He says, "The Lord knows the days of the upright, and their inheritance shall be forever. They shall not be ashamed in the evil time, and in the days of famine they shall be satisfied." He says that when the bad times hit, God's going to take care of you. And you know, brethren, we see these examples in the Scriptures, and they tell us that hard times come upon God's people. And as we know that that may happen, and we look at the world out ahead of us, what's coming, we need to do our best to be prepared spiritually, and where need be, to be prepared physically, so that as we face those times, then we're spiritually ready, and as we can be physically ready, we can be so. But more than anything else, we need to look to our God to see us through such times, and He will. That's the encouragement of the Scriptures. So as we face hard times ahead, never lose sight of the fact that God's with you and He will see you through.